Hello and welcome to the Daily Buzz presented by Cloud Electronics. We are here at day two of South by Southwest 2014 at the gorgeous Stateside Theater. My name is Dave Karger. I'm the chief correspondent at Fandango. And joining me are my co-hosts Kim Voyner from Movie City News, Kristen McCracken from The Playlist, and Amy Nicholson from LA Weekly. And we are very happy to have with us three other people to join us for an interactive South by Southwest roundtable. We have JJ Kaleo from Forbes, Aya Zook from Microsoft Ventures, and Brent Rose from Gizmodo. Hello, everybody.
Hey.
I'm hoping we can start off just by going around and just tell everyone who you are again and what you're up to here at South by.
So my name is Brent Rose. I do a lot of work for Gizmodo. I also write for like Wired and Outside Magazine and stuff like that. And I'm basically just here to find something interesting and write about the weird, cool stuff that maybe hasn't blown up yet.
I'm Aya from Microsoft Ventures, and we do investments in early stage startups. And there's no better place to find those at the mecca of startups at Interactive.
I'm JJ from Forbes, and I write about startups and tech and that sort of thing. So it's a very logical place to come and take meetings and find out what's happening and shoot some video with a lot of interesting people in one place. So, yeah.
I should say, this is Dave from Fandango. I'm here as a juror along with Amy from LA Weekly. We're jurors on the documentary.
Yes, we are two angry critics.
I'm a lover, not a fighter.
I'm a fighter.
And
have you guys seen Print the Legend?
That is today.
I saw a screening of it before, and it's fascinating. It's like it ties Interactive and film together so well. It's
great.
A fascinating story about the startups, the 3D printing startups, and all the kind of backbiting. And I put it on kind of thinking, well, this will be interesting. But then it was just like riveting. I thought it was really
There's also a great 3D printing joke in the movie Neighbors.
Oh, yeah.
And if you know that the movie takes place at a frat house with a whole bunch of guys, you can probably... And if you know they're playing pranks on other people, you can probably imagine something that they would use a 3D printer for.
You know what, making knitting needles so they can quilt?
That's exactly right. That's exactly what they use it for.
Charming.
And Kristen, what are you up to here?
I'm here doing interviews for The Playlist on IndieWire. So yesterday I did some interviews with the movie The Heart Machine, which is a narrative feature that's in competition here, made by Zachary Wigan, who's also a film critic writer who's making his movie debut, which is pretty cool. And I interviewed Juliet Lewis and Johnny Weston last night for Kelly and Cal, which is a really sweet movie about two kind of misfits who find each other and have an interesting relationship. So,
now, it definitely seems like the interactive portion of South By, which is the newest, you know, compared to the music and the film sections, it's the one that seems to be the biggest right now. I mean, everywhere you turn, you meet someone.
Well, and it's grown exponentially. I was last here in 2008, and Interactive was not nearly as big as it is now, so I was kind of blown away just like looking over the schedule, trying to wrap my head around everything that there is to see. One of the things that I'm kind of interested in about Interactive this year is the word convergence, which we keep seeing and hearing a lot, both in Interactive and in film. So I'd be interested in hearing what these gentlemen think about the idea of convergence, the convergence of social media and tech and film, and what you're seeing around the festival related to that.
You know, it's one of the popular buzzwords for sure, but
is it this year's ubiquitous or
you know, yeah, it's you know, there's always disrupt and there's convergence and synergy and wearables. You know, it's just been like, you know, every year we've got, you know, some new buzzwords. It's like, okay, now we all got to get on this trend, or we got to get on that.
Can we have some synergistic convergence with you?
Absolutely. I think we're, yeah, that's like the singular.
Singularity.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no turning back after that.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. I think people are just, you know, there are a lot of companies who are just trying to make a name for themselves here, and there are a lot of people here who are trying to find a hole to throw their money into. And so it's, you know, of course it becomes
Wait,
a
where
big
are those people?
Frothing. They're around. They're lurking.
Wait, but seriously, do these words mean anything? Because this is all new to me. I just cover movies and a little bit of music. I don't want this whole convergence, synergy, all these words. Is it just a way for people to have a language that they all can feel like they're all in on? Or do these things actually translate into meaningful collaborations?
Well, I think as technology has gone mainstream, like our daily lives, so much of it's driven by technology. So I think we're actually seeing some of this technology seeping into our physical world in a lot more, I guess, stronger and more apparent ways than we did before. So there is a convergence that's happening, definitely.
I mean, I think there's an evolution to these words where they start out, somebody comes up with them and there maybe is some meaning. You know, they're actually referring to something concrete, and then they kind of take a life of their own and they're adopted by all of these kind of imitators or, you know, people who just hear it and realize that it has some power and it makes you sound intelligent, and it just becomes jargon and meaningless pretty quickly. So I think as journalists, it's kind of our job to cut through that. And when we hear convergence or any one of these buzzwords, disrupt, you know, guru, whatever, ninja, we kind of like shut off. But I do think there is some truth to what Aya is saying in terms of, you know, we're here and there's film, there's interactive, and there's music, and technology is obviously influencing all these industries in a lot of different ways. So there's at least some reality to that.
Well, and the word convergence may be jargon to an extent, but for me, like, South By kind of epitomizes a festival where it actually is relevant because of those three components of the fest, much more than Sundance or Toronto, right? Mm-hmm. And I've been talking a lot with fellow journalists at the fest about how technology has kind of taken over. Even, like, you can't just be a film critic anymore. It's not enough to be a critic. You have to be a social media expert. You have to be on Twitter. You have to be making quick videos that you're putting out within, you know, an hour of seeing a film. And South By is a place where all that is really coming together and the interactive side is exploding a lot more.
Well, I think the true test will be if next year's South By, we have a enterprising young filmmaker who was walking down 6th Street, overheard you guys say convergence, and made a sci-fi movie about it. That'll be the test.
Within an hour. And had it posted on YouTube.
Exactly.
And was tweeting about it.
You know, Dave and I have been stuck in the dark watching documentaries all day. And the only cool tech thing I've seen is some guy was trying to show off a glowing business card. Like, what kind of cool stuff are you guys seeing since you're out in the real world?
Well, the one thing that I saw that was pretty cool is this company called the iTribe. And they're a Danish company, and they do really affordable eye tracking software. So anybody can buy this kit for $99 and attach it to their tablet and basically shoot laser from their eyes, virtually, of course, but... I mean, that's
what?
As good as it
gets. Wait,
what?
Wait.
Say that again.
So you can control the application with your eye movement.
So you like it's something that you wear.
So you're like playing a game. You can just look at it and like shoot the fruit or whatever.
So it's kind of like that Star Trek Next Generation episode where they had the little headband thing on and everybody was actually being controlled by aliens?
Not that bad. Yeah.
See, this is the world that we're in. When you just said eye tracking, I'm so into this whole Apple everything that I was visualizing the letter I tracking. I'm like, is this something I've never heard of? But you're talking about the part of our body called an eye.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That sounds fascinating. And have people just been swarming them, trying to write
I think
about
they just shipped. So, you know, it's kind of up to everybody who adopts the technology to see what they can do with it. And that's the exciting part, that people are building platforms for other people to kind of latch on and do whatever that makes sense.
I have to admit, if that's going to be used for video games, it scares me that kids won't even be using their hands anymore, that we'll now become like official Jabba the Hutt pod people.
Well, they'll probably be tweeting at the same time, so it's super efficient.
They will, right.
I think the craziest thing I saw was this this company called Chaotic Moon, which is actually based out of Austin. They do a lot of software stuff, but they decided just to start a conversation about drones and their capabilities, built this hexacopter that has a 80,000-volt taser built into it. And it can essentially, if somebody's on your property and trips a sensor, it'll automatically deploy, intercept you, and send you a picture of whoever it is they've intercepted. And if you're like, oh, that's my Aunt Helen, it's fine, you hit a button and it goes back home. But if you're like, oh no, I don't know who that person is, intercept, it'll say, you are, you know, in violation of something, turn around and walk away. And if you turn around and walk away, you're fine. And if you don't, if you keep coming, it'll shoot you with these darts, these barbed darts, and pump 80,000 volts into you until you're on the ground. And then if you try to get up again, it'll continue pumping voltage into you until the police show up, until you just lie there.
What? And does it sound like RoboCop?
I didn't hear its voice, but I saw a demo of it. This is actually a real thing that already works, already exists, and they're demoing it. They demoed it on a dummy.
Is it legal?
No. Well, it wouldn't be legal to do that.
In Texas.
Yeah. Texas, you get mocked down the street with a gun on your shoulder.
Just like your own personal
concealed drone.
With a taser.
Right. And it's basically just to start the conversation. So they say, I mean, maybe they're actually doing it for the defense, you know, Department of Defense. But right now they've gotten around some of the legal restrictions by flying it manually rather than having it autonomously do that. Like right now you can't have a car alarm that would just shock people.
You can't.
People want to. People have tried that. But you're not allowed to have a car alarm that automatically shocks people.
Those taser drones would be kind of handy on 6th Street about 2 a.m. when all the drunk guys wandered out. Back away. Back away. Yeah.
Well, we appreciate your time, guys. Thanks for telling us about all the weird and wonderful things that we're going to be bringing into our lives in the next couple of years, I'm sure. Brent, Aya, and JJ, thank you so much. Enjoy your time here.
Yeah. Thank you
for having us.
Thanks, guys.
We are now happy to be joined by an actor who has two films here at South by Southwest this year, Boyhood and Predestination. Welcome, Ethan Hawke.
Thanks for having
me. We're very happy to have you here.
Yeah.
This festival for you, I think, kind of encapsulates this point that you're at in your career where you're doing all of these different kinds of films. A film that took 12 years to make with Richard Linklater, and then a really trippy, more action-oriented film, Predestination. Is that something that excites you to be at one festival with two films?
It does, and you're right. It's an example of kind of the weird balancing act I've been trying to do for the last couple of years, which is mixing odd genre movies with our film. You know, I mean, that basically, if you want to have a career as a professional actor, you can't, or only a couple people a generation get to just do exactly what they want all the time, you know. And one of the ways that I've found to skin the cat as far as having a professional career is to get to make all kinds of different movies. And a few years ago I made this movie Daybreakers with these really talented crazy Australian guys. I'd seen this weird movie The Undead, and I guess this taps into my just basic love of movies. And because my first film was with Joe Dante when I was 13, which was, he came from Roger Corman and all these kind of weird genre movies, you know, basically drive-in movies, The Howling, and that's where The Piranha, Joe had gotten his start. And so Joe had kind of infused me at 13, 14 with the subversive nature of genre films and what you can do with them. And the Spirit Brothers are a great example of that. I mean, you know, some people may think Daybreakers is one thing, but Daybreakers is an old-fashioned John Carpenter movie, which is, you know, it's a vampire movie, but really it's a socio-political. there's a neat thing that's happening inside that movie that I think John Carpenter would be proud of, for example. And I really wanted to work with them again because it was kind of obvious on Daybreakers how much they were learning. And
how old are they at this point?
God, you know, I don't know, but they're in their early 30s.
And we should tell people, they wrote this film, Predestination, they produced it, they directed it. One of them wrote the music. I mean, these guys are, they have their hands in everything.
Multi-talented. Yeah.
They're real, true blue film lovers, you know, and they, when you work with them, what's exciting, there's a great old Cassavetes line, which is that I like anybody who makes films as long as they put everything they've got into it. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't kind of matter if it's a weepy or a sci-fi thriller or a horror movie or whatever, as long as you're really putting your whole self in the movie. You know, certain genre movies are bad when it's just people trying to make a buck. But you can tell with the Spirits, they're not just trying to make a buck. They're trying to make a movie worth watching. And there's that. And then with Boyhood, obviously, I mean, this is kind of part of my life's work, is my collaboration with Richard Linklater. And we started Boyhood before we started Before Sunset. I read these things and say, well, you know, Richard is continuing with what he learned from the Before trilogy, and you're like, no, actually, we didn't even know Before would be a sequel when we started Boyhood.
Wow.
But it is part of these ongoing long-term life projects that Rick and I have engaged in. And so they really are extremely different, but they're both meaningful to me in their own way.
If we could just jump back to Predestination for a minute, because I saw that last night and really loved the film. One of the things I really liked about it is the way it merges sci-fi and kind of this art house mentality. And you talked in the Q&A about when you got the script, reading it and just kind of being blown away by it. Can you just talk a little bit about why you like sci-fi and what about this script made you really want to do the project?
Well, it lets you... Sci-fi is a entry point where it's this genre heading in which you can kind of do whatever you want. And you can have a dialogue. Like, there's a case to be made that predestination is about the masculine and feminine inside each one of us, mm-hmm. and how they're at war with each other and how they're the balance of the universe. I mean, you could, but if you start talking about that, you sound like a pretentious, you know, like you're making some kind of important socio-political movie, which we're not. We're telling a thriller inside of which there's all these kind of conversations that you can have. And that's what I love about science fiction. I mean, you know, science fiction or fantasy, you know, if you take the Lord of the Rings, the ring is kind of an obvious symbol for the ego. You know, and how the ego can eat up the universe if you let it. But it's not that. It's about hobbits and elves, and you know what I mean? And
right,
so,
right.
So that's what I like about it. You know, The Purge is another good example of you can make a movie about Trayvon Martin, or you could make a movie called The Purge, in which you deal with all those kind of class issues and kind of throw them into the psyche without preaching to people. You just tell them an entertaining story. You know, Star Wars, for example, doesn't try to teach you how to be a Jedi Knight. Mm. It just entertains you, and when it's over, you kind of feel like you know how to become one.
Right, right.
That's what I like about science
fiction. And Predestination had so many layers going on with it. It was such a complex story. And I'm wondering, when you first read the script, did you have any concerns about, is an audience going to be able to follow this and keep up with it? Like, were you able to keep up with it the first time you read it?
If you don't have concerns about the audience being able to keep up with it, then you didn't read the script. I mean, it's out of its mind.
Right.
I mean, the only thing I can say that was anything like it that I'd read it in screenplay was Linklater's Scanner Darkly. Mm. You know, which is Philip K. Dick, Robert Heinlein, they, you know, Ray Bradbury, George Orwell. There's a certain group of them, you know, the really, truly great science fiction writers. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure I even did totally understand the script when I first read it. I knew I found it really engaging, and I wanted to read it a second time. And some things you don't understand, and they're bad, you know, because
right.
they don't make sense. This I didn't understand, and I liked it, though. You know, I wanted to figure out what it was about. And I felt kind of, a strange thing to say, but I felt kind of proud that this was the movie those guys wanted to make next. Hmm. Because it's a dangerous movie. It's not an easy, simple...
And probably not the easiest sell, right?
So it's, yeah.
How do you pitch that?
Look, let me tell you, there were a lot of people who told me not to do the movie. You know, a lot of people read the script and didn't understand it. Or I think in 10 years from now, there's no doubt in my mind that this movie will find its fans. I mean, it's an interesting movie, and it's really worth thinking about what it's actually about. I find it really moving, and I find Sarah Snook's performance incredible, and I love seeing a movie that's kind of about cross-gender, that's not about... It's about something else, it just happens to deal with it. And I find that really interesting. The nature of love... You know, you can make a case that predestination is all about learning to love yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. It's a fascinating thing that your brain can kind of spin around. But did I understand it when I first read it? No.
And did you ever go back to read the short story, or had you read it before?
I hadn't read it before, but it takes 5 minutes. The short story is brilliant, but it's only it's somewhere, depending on what edition you get, it's either 4 or 6 pages long. It's not long. It's mostly all just the conversation in the bar.
And then they just expanded on that. And
they just ripped on the idea.
And...
The Heinlein idea is a snake that eats its own tail. What if somebody was traveling in time and was there in the space-time continuum was their own parent? Which a Buddhist scholar would tell you that we're all our own mother anyway, you know, through reincarnation. And, you know, so it's a trippy... You see why I did the movie. I get a kick out of it.
Yeah, it's very heady. And what's up next for you? I know you're directing a documentary. Do you have any other narrative projects coming up that you want to talk about quickly?
Yeah, I'm shooting right now. I leave tonight to go back to film Andrew Nichol's new movie, which is another sci-fi movie. I did Gattaca. Mm.
Love Gattaca.
Yeah, me too. I love that movie too. So we're doing a movie that kind of explores the ethics of the drone pilots, and or not the ethics of the pilots themselves, but the ethics of the drone strikes, and its effect on the pilots, you know, and so that's been really interesting, and then I'm gonna. I don't know, I've got a bunch of different things on
this. A bunch of different things.
Including a red carpet you have to get to.
I know. Boy, this red carpet's been 12 years in the making. Get my ass on that red carpet.
You better go do that. All right, Ethan Hawk, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, you guys.
All right.
Joining us now is the director of one of the most anticipated films here at South By, and that is Veronica Mars, the film version of the cult favorite TV show, Rob Thomas. Great to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What an exciting couple of days it's been for you. Not only did you have an official South by Southwest screening yesterday, but I think you also had your Kickstarter premiere a little bit outside of town. Is that right?
That's right. We, out in suburban Austin, the Kickstarter backers who had kicked in $750 or more all had two seats for last night's premiere, and that was rowdy. You know, the afternoon screening was a film festival crowd. And then out at the Alamo Lake Line last night, it was just the crazy Veronica Mars fans, and that was wonderful.
How many people gave $750? Do you know?
Well, we sold out premieres in New York, L.A., and Los Angeles, and last night they had four screens going at the Alamo. So there were a lot of people there last night.
Say crazy, what do you mean? I mean, I'm wondering, like, because I know your fans are covered in marshmallows. Is anybody actually covered in marshmallows?
No one came covered in marshmallows, but they are. It is, you know, whenever I'm around them, I feel like I'm Gene Roddenberry or something, and they have theories on the show, and they watched in such detail. I'll get questions like, you remember in season two, Veronica walked into the room and her bracelet was on backwards. Now, my theory on why that bracelet was on backwards was because she was remembering Lily.
Oh, wow.
And I think it was just that a wardrobe person put it on backwards. We had not imbued it with that much meaning.
But obviously you just say yes.
Yes, yes. You figured us out. Yeah.
You made a lot of people really happy yesterday, I think, with all the inside jokes and the appearances of everybody. It was just so great. Was it gratifying to have that feedback from the audience?
Incredibly so. I would have died yesterday if the movie had not gotten the laughs that we were hoping for, or people hadn't responded in the way they did. We've invested, you know, so much of the last year into making the movie, and then really the 7-year quest to get it made, that if I didn't feel like it had worked last night, I would have been unable to get out of bed today. But we were feeling good this morning. We had great reactions at both screenings.
A couple weeks ago, I did an interview with Kristen for my Fandango show, Weekend Ticket, and I showed up at this very small press day that I guess a couple of the cast members were doing, and there was the cast signing, I think it was 6,500 posters each, because that's how many people paid whatever amount it was to get the poster. In retrospect, would you have completely changed all of the financial thresholds? Because four movie theaters full of premiere winners, 6,500 posters, it's crazy.
It is, and I think the craziest part of it was the posters. Like, that is the thing we would rethink this time around, or next time around. We might have made a more limited version of that, because I have now spent 3 days signing posters, and at the end of day three, I thought I was done, and I celebrated, I tweeted out, I finished my posters. And then someone said, there are 8 more boxes at Kristen Bell's house. And it was a heartbreaking moment. I had even put a big exclamation point and tweeted out, hey, last person, you got an exclamation point. Tweet me back when you find it. Like, it was Willy Wonka's golden ticket. But really, there are 1,000 more for me to sign.
How was your wrist holding
up? Yeah.
Yeah, I did it in 3 sort of blocks, and I got the second Game Change book on tape, and I just get into a zone.
Nice.
I have a poster flipper for me, and yeah, it just the but hours go by.
They're authentic.
They are authentic. Although I have to say, I will see changes. Like, I get bored doing my signature a certain way, and I will try flair. You know, I will try different signatures, but. Yeah, you get a little bored.
Awful. People will think they got an imposter.
I know. I think the Ob Amos ends up looking the same each time. The R and the T become many experiments.
You know, I'm sure because this movie is the poster child for a successful Kickstarter campaign, you've gotten questions like this a lot, but it seems like Kickstarter is a very tricky line to walk because there, I think there's people in the public who will look at a Kickstarter campaign some of the times and say, why is this person asking for my money? Right. Why is Zach Braff asking for my money? What's the trick to doing it in a way where people out there don't feel like it's so some rich person asking them for money?
Right. Well, I think there are a couple things. One, I would say, don't worry about how other people spend their money. I mean, I think that's one of the things. The thing about the Zach Braff one, and he has certainly caught a lot of heat, but I thought he was very honest in the way he presented his. He said, I've got a certain amount of money. At a certain amount more, I will be able to have final say on casting. That's what I'm looking to finance. And he ran a really well-run campaign, and I appreciated that. It was a beautiful presentation, great rewards. He took it very seriously. And then everyone who gives to it, they can factor in. He is a rich sitcom actor. Do I want to give him money? And if they want to, more power to him. That's their financial decision. You know, in our case, I think because we were aligned with the studio, we had our own moral predicament. Mm-hmm. And I think that with us, the thing that I think would have been bad is if it appeared that we were like holding the Veronica Mars title hostage and ordering fans to pay up. So it was important to us that our reward tiers were fair. So like at $35, people got a T-shirt, a download of the movie, and a script, and that felt fair to me. You know, it felt like a good deal, and that reward and the $50 reward, which was all that plus the physical DVD with the documentary, I felt good about presenting those. I think we could not have done a Kickstarter thing where we gave a $4 tote bag for $100. That would have felt like holding the title hostage and making fans cough up. So I would say each Kickstarter campaign can be judged on its own merits. Mm-hmm. And if you don't believe in it, don't give to it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times you'll see those fail that don't handle that well.
And what are the expectations for the box office when you have this kind of other side of things where people are getting the movie for their donation? I mean, is the studio worried about that, or you think it's just going to take off?
I have no idea. I have done my
whole... It's also day and date, right?
Right, VOD right, and yeah. I have had a whole career of having cult shows, of the word cult being attached to everything I do. I just want to have something that actually does make money, that is profitable at the end of the day. And the nice thing about this Veronica Mars movie is we don't have to make a ton of money to be profitable. I do think that if for it to be sort of gauged a success, you know, by the Hollywood community, I think if we, you know, do well at the box office, do great on VOD, that we would pave the way for other movies like this. You know,
super exciting.
Well, thank you. I think one of the things that have been falling away over time are those, you know, movies made in the $5 to $10 million range. And if we're successful, I would hope that more movies happen like this.
Well, speaking of your cult shows, the internet also really wants a Party Down movie. Do you think you have any energy to go through this again?
I do have energy. With Party Down, I think, you know, the bigger battle is those actors have all scattered to the wind, and trying to make the stars align so we could all get back together would be a challenge. But we have not given up on Party Down. The wheels are turning on that. They've been turning slowly, but we are still hopeful that there will be Party Down again.
Well, the one thing I'm telling people about Veronica Mars, because people have asked me, is does it matter if you haven't seen the show? Will you still like the movie? And I think the answer is, heck yes. Okay. I think, obviously, there's a lot of Easter egg kind of things in there for the real hardcore fans to enjoy, but I think that even if you've never seen it, these are fun characters and a really interesting mystery, so I imagine that was a priority for you too.
Yeah, I mean, I will admit that when I started writing the movie, because it was fan-funded, I very much wrote for the fans. I thought that the movie could be successful if we just got those 2 or 3 million people who watched the show to the movie theater. But given all the publicity that the Kickstarter campaign got and getting the big room at Comic-Con and the cover of Entertainment Weekly, at some point the studio said, maybe this could cross over. And we did make a couple of decisions later in the process. We added a two-minute opening.
That was smart.
That was really smart.
Yeah, that tried to bring newbies up to speed on the Veronica Mars mythology, but give it in a very bite-sized section, and hopefully people will have heard the buzz and want to check it out.
And hopefully you'll send them back to Netflix to watch the series.
That would be great. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we congratulate you on it, and a very exciting time, and you must be very sleep-deprived, but you've managed to put some sentences together. So
well thanks.
Done, Rob.
Thanks.
Rob Thomas, director of Veronica Mars, thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you all.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
We are here with Darius Clark Monroe, who is here with his film Evolution of a Criminal, which was exec produced by Spike Lee. Is that correct?
Yes.
We're also being joined now by David Marshall, director of Beginning with the End. Beginning with the End is a film about hospice, and about a high school teacher who teaches high school class and teaches them to be hospice volunteers. Getting back to Darius.
It's about when I was 16 years old, and my family was going through some hard times, and myself and two other classmates concocted a plan to rob a bank, and we actually did rob that bank. And the film explores the reasons why young kids make the choices that they make, how you can easily be influenced to make criminal decisions, but it also explores how you can come out of that bad choice and still find a way to realign yourself and get focused and do something positive with your life.
What would make a 16-year-old honor student think, I have a great idea?
Bank robbery.
Bank robbery. That's my next thing.
You know, it's so weird because bank robbery is almost like just a part of the culture. We almost crack jokes about it all the time, about just, I wonder if I would ever do that or do this. But at the time, when you're 16, it didn't seem like this far-fetched thing. It felt very realistic. It was like, okay, I've seen it. I was watching Cops, and I was watching America's Most Wanted.
Right.
And there were all these guys getting away with these small little robberies, and so we saw this small bank, and I kept trying to rationalize it. Well, this is, you know, FDIC. This is not really personal property. Maybe we'll get a few bucks that can help out the household. I don't know how this is going to go. And when you're 16, you're thinking, oh, this is just an institution. But then, as you can see in the film, you don't realize that it's the individuals who are being impacted, who are just there doing their normal day-to-day banking business, who are also going to be a part of this tragedy.
Like, when you're doing a documentary about your own story, how hard is it to be hard on yourself or to be truthful?
To me, like, you just have to be truthful. And it's tough, but it's like, as a subject, if you're going to be the director and the subject, you have to be harder on yourself than everybody else in the film. And you have to be upfront, and you have to be raw, and the flaws just have to be out. Because no one's going to believe anything if you're faking the funk. And so to me, it was just putting it all out on the table and just seeing where, you know, how it's going to land. Whether people are going to judge it good or bad, I just decided not to focus on that, but just to keep the truth at the forefront. I really wanted to make a film about compassion and forgiveness, and how it's, you know, a lot of times we preach, you know, you have to forgive, you have to be kind to your neighbor, to your brother, to your sister, but it's not really put into work. And I really wanted to just show that it's possible to do something as horrific as this robbery, and you see people who do forgive you, people who are inside the bank who had a horrible time going through that, and it's something powerful. I never imagined that people would say, I do forgive you, and I thank you for coming to my doorstep to tell me that you're sorry. That was a big thing for me.
I hope you don't mind this question, but I've never robbed a bank, and I'm curious, what's just that moment like of nerves when you just push open that door and go inside?
You know, it's one of those things where the moment you go through the door, I just kept telling myself, okay, now that we're through the door, just hurry up and get it over with. It's almost like you're not even thinking, it's a blur.
You're in it now.
Yeah, you're in it, from a legal standpoint, the moment you walk through the door with the shotgun, you have robbed the bank whether you take anything or not.
Really? You don't even have to open your mouth?
You don't have to. I mean, the moment you walk in there with the gun, and even if you decide to just walk right back out, you just came in there with the gun, and you can be charged for an aggravated
felony. Oh, I didn't know that.
Felony. And so once we went through that door, it was like, just hurry up, get this money, and get out as fast as you can. And it's one of those things where it just happened. It felt like it happened 20 seconds, although we were in there for like a minute and a half. It just feels like a blur, and then it's over. And then for the rest of the day, and for the rest of, well, until I got arrested, you just suffer from extreme paranoia because you're just waiting for the SWAT team to come down and get you.
And I want to jump over to David, if we could now, and talk about Beginning with the End and how this project evolved. How did you get interested in making a film about hospice?
Well, I'd known the main character of the film, Bob Kane, for about 25 years. So about 5 years, I'd been interested in making this film and kind of pushing him to let me get my camera inside a classroom and inside these comfort care homes that we eventually worked with. So eventually, he kind of acquiesced, and we decided how we would approach that, because the real issue was not affecting the class, because this is a very intimate kind of story. It's a very private and personal story for many people. So for us, it was kind of navigating that. And we spent a good 6 months just figuring out how the camera plays, what we should do, what we shouldn't do. And that was what Ashley, my associate producer, and I worked on very, very hard and long, making sure that we were not going to affect the outcomes for these students.
Was it challenging to get the rights that you needed from all the individuals involved? I mean, you're going into a place where people are dying, right? It's the end of their lives. And did you have any issues dealing with families or dealing with any of the people in hospice, or did they welcome this idea of this film?
I spent a lot of time just being in the place, so people became very accustomed to me. So the families really wanted us to tell these stories. One of the things that I thought was going to be a big problem is exactly that. I thought, well, this is going to be the end of this story, really, is that people won't let us in. And what turned out was...
Because
it's such a private experience. But they really, they had such a wonderful time at these comfort care homes. The experience was so beautiful that they wanted others to get a chance to see that. And so the families were not an issue. They were welcoming us into the story.
Have any of the families gotten to see it since, to see their loved ones again?
A couple of them were at the... We did a show for all the students and parents and so forth for them to see the film. And a number of the family members came to that. And that was lovely. That was really lovely to see them seeing their family member up on the screen and, just remembering that piece of their story.
And what was their feedback on the film generally? Were they happy that they...
And the
allowed
students
you
the
into their
oh,
lives?
Definitely, I think so, across the board, yeah.
And what about the students?
Well, they're more worried about being pimply or something. I mean, they're there's a lot
of
tight
shots in my film.
Oh,
my eyes look so puffy because I'm crying.
Right, exactly. So we got a lot of that. But I think overall, everyone's been really pleased with how we approached it. I mean, obviously, we did that we gave them that opportunity because we wanted to make sure that they were comfortable with how we presented them. It was really important to us that we do this in a way that honors the opportunity they gave us to be with them at the end of their lives.
And is this hospice class program, is this a unique thing to this school and this teacher? I've never heard of a high school class on hospice where they're teaching students to be volunteers.
I think it is, but I don't think it should be. One of the things that comes out of this is that these students are so good at this. They're so gifted, given a chance to be empathetic, given a chance to cross that kind of that border and be in an adult situation and be asked to care and be compassionate. They're extraordinary.
And seeing these high school seniors, these guys rubbing these these
women's
feet and putting the socks on, and she keeps taking the socks off. That one almost brought me to tears, having gone through hospice with my grandmother a few years ago.
There's a lot of lovely little moments in this. And I think what the film hopefully offers people is a chance to see that there are extraordinary opportunities to get sort of the gifts of what life is about out of these little moments. And that's what we wanted people to get from this. That sitting with someone, just taking their socks off and putting their socks on as a game, can be a wonderful thing to do. And it can be a gift to you and a gift to them. That being with someone watching snow is more important than anything else
you
can do.
Which is a lovely moment in the film also, right?
So those are the things I want people to get from this. That your life is defined by what you achieve, how much money you make. It isn't. It's going to be defined by who you've loved and who loves you. And that's what we want the essence of this to be. And for teenagers who are moving on into the bigger life, to get a chance to get that nugget then and to
when you're 17 and not when you're 40 or 45 and looking back
brilliant.
On your life.
Every kid should have that chance. Every kid should have a chance to do something like this, because it argues, what do you want to do? What do you want your story to be when you're offering it to someone else?
Which is kind of both of these films.
I know,
are,
I'd love,
are,
I'm going to have to see your film
now.
I really want to see your
movie. Yeah, I'll give you a ticket, no problem.
All right, same here.
All right, thank you very much. We've been talking to Darius Clark Monroe with Evolution of a Criminal, David Marshall with Beginning with the End here at South by Southwest. Thank you guys so much for stopping by
thank
and joining
so
us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Hi, we've just been joined by four female directors who all have films at the festival. Let me say hello to all of them. We have Jen McGowan from Kelly and Cal. We have Leah Meyerhoff of I Believe in Unicorns, Anya Markart of She's Lost Control, and George Hinken of Soulboys of the Western World. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd love you guys to just take a second, introduce yourselves, and tell us a little bit about your film and how South By is going for you. Let's start over here with Jen.
Okay, great. Thanks. My name's Jen McGowan, and my film is Kelly and Cal, with Juliette Lewis, Johnny Weston, Josh Hopkins, Sybil Shepherd, Margaret Collin. It's about a woman who is having a bit of an identity crisis. It's a comedy, though, so don't worry. And how she connects with a young boy in her neighborhood. And it's a character piece about their relationship.
My name is Leah Meyerhoff, and my film is called I Believe in Unicorns. And it is the story of a 16-year-old girl named Davina who runs away from home with an older boy and discovers that their new life together is not the fantasy she had imagined. And it stars rising talents Natalia Dyer, Peter Vack, Julia Garner, Amy Simons, and my mother, Toni Meyerhoff. It's a personal story.
Hi, I'm Anya. She's Lost Control. It's a story about a woman who is teaching her clients how to be intimate, and it's a suspense drama with two people meeting, Burke Bloom and Mark Menchaca. Stuff happens.
I'm George Hinken. My film is a feature documentary. Soulboys of the Western World is about a band called Spandau Ballet, who were five kids who met at school in Islington in North London in the 70s, and together created this band that went on to be huge, enormous, to kind of soundtrack the 80s. In Europe, and in the US, I guess True has now had 5 million radio plays. I made the film using 100% archive. I was lucky that the band had home movie footage, fantastic home movie footage on Super 8, and then there's this whole, it's kind of like a Soulboy Senna, if you saw that movie Senna. It's made up of archive and manages to be a very intimate portrait of friendship and celebrity.
Was it a challenge to get the rights to use all that archival footage?
We had a great archive producer, Kate Griffith, and the archive process started before anything else. There were some things that were trickier than others, but luckily we got a great deal with the BBC, a great deal with ITN. And the main difficulty was sifting through 500 hours worth of archive in order to determine which was the most compelling stuff to use.
Wow.
Wait, Leah, I am so curious about something you said. Your mother is in this film, and it's based on, it sounds like, your own personal true story. How is it to direct your mother?
Quite challenging and rewarding. I actually, before making I Believe in Unicorns, I made a short film which also starred my mother while I was at NYU as my thesis, and to try it out. And basically, my mother has MS. She's in a wheelchair and has been for my entire life. And in writing this story, that was the semi-autobiographical part. And I originally thought I would cast an actress. And in doing so, in that casting process, realized I really needed my own mother to play this part. There's something so organic in that physicality of her disability. And she did a fantastic job. And we also cast a real 16-year-old girl to play the 16-year-old lead. And so what we did is, before we started shooting, brought the 16-year-old actress to my mother's house and had them hang out and just get into character and get to know each other. So it was emotionally challenging, obviously. I have a lot of baggage with my own mother, but incredibly rewarding, and brought us closer together in real life as well.
Does your mother always take your direction, or was she ever like, Leah, honey?
Sometimes she's like, no.
Or was she ever like, that's not how it went down.
That's not how it went down. Yeah. I was like, it's fictional.
Well, Jen, I would love to ask you, when I saw your film, Kelly and Cal, the first 20 minutes made me decide I never wanted to have children ever again.
I'm right there with you.
I mean, Juliette Lewis is a new mother. She's her baby is like 6 weeks old when the film starts.
Yes.
And it cries all the time. And it doesn't really like it when she holds her. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about, like, this? I love this view of motherhood, because I feel like in film so much it's just, like, saintly and baby powder smelling in all of this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wish my writer were here. Amy Lowe Starbin, who's great, she and I went to USC, and that's kind of how we connected. And she, you know, she got the ideas based on, you know, her experience of being a new mom and how it's not what's represented in films. It's not, you know, there's the two extremes. There's that, oh, it's funny, it's pooping and throwing up on everything, ha-ha. And then there's the other, which is everything's perfect. Aren't you happy? You know, you have the ability to create a human being. But we wanted to do something that was more authentic to her experience and not mine, because like I said, I don't have kids, but I connect to the more universal themes in the film of identity and growing up and marriage and all those things.
Well, and it's definitely proliferated throughout the media that, as you know, as a woman, as a mom of five kids myself, you know, when my kids were younger, there was so much inundation of motherhood is like this saintly, awesome thing. You should want to be a stay-at-home mom. You should just want to spend all your time sitting on the floor playing blocks and playing Candyland, and you know.
I think that puts a lot of pressure on
women. It puts tremendous pressure.
Because when their experience doesn't line up perfectly with the image that we've told them it's meant to be, there's a little bit of a crisis, and that's what's happening in the film.
Let's jump over to Anya, and can you talk a little bit about the genesis of your film and the subject matter? I'm really interested in hearing more about that.
Well, it's really about you know, the question of how professional intimacy has sort of an impact on our lives, and by professional intimacy, I always view it as something that we all do in our, you know, interactions with you know, people that we work with, or just, you know, in some urban context. It's something that is a substitute for intimacy, and it feels exhilarating and you know, it feels like the real deal, but it's not. So, you know, I really was interested in looking at, okay, what does it really mean if two people connect and without any of the barriers that we usually put up to protect ourselves. So it was kind of like a laboratory situation also for the actors. I cast Mark Menchaca actually before casting Burt Bloom because I had to recast the lead role and push the shoot to work with Brooke because she was just fantastic in the audition. And so it came to a point where I thought, okay, let's just keep these actors apart, you know. I don't want to rehearse with them beforehand. I don't want to have them be too comfortable with each other, so we just jumped into it.
So the tension on screen is like real, real.
Mm-hmm. To some degree, yeah.
I like that. That's super smart. Well, ladies, thank you so much for coming in. I hope the rest of your week goes very well. Again, we had Dor Chenkin from Soul Boys of the Western World. We have Anya Markart from She's Lost Control. We have Leah Meyerhoff from I Believe in Unicorns. And we have Jen McCallan from Kelly and Cal.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for stopping by. Have a great South By.
Thank you.
I am here with Jared Neese, who is one of the programmers here at South by Southwest on the Midnight section. And Lee Janiak from the film Honeymoon. Welcome to the show. We're here to talk about the Midnight section, which is one of my favorite sections at any festival, but especially South By, because you guys do such a fabulous job of programming it, Jared.
Thank you.
I'd like to start out with you talking a little bit about how you find the films. I know a lot of them are submitted to you, but you also go to other festivals. So what are you looking for when you're evaluating films and deciding whether they're going to have one of the coveted Midnight slots at this festival?
Yes, we do get a lot of submissions. Like a film like Lee's was submitted to us, and I didn't see it at another festival or anything. We have open submissions, and then we do a lot of travel to places like Toronto and Sundance and Sitges and various other festivals along the way, Fantasia. We're seeing a lot of films there, but we're also meeting a lot of filmmakers and making a lot of connections, and so maybe we're not going to play that film, but... you know, like with the instance of a lot of these films that we're playing this year, or filmmakers that I've made relationships with along the way, and they brought me their next film, and so it's just a lot of lead advance time, like, you know, developing these relationships, and then at the same time creating this program and the festival that we have that. You know, that it has acquisitions and that it has, you know, the right press and the right buyers and the right audiences. And that lends itself for people wanting to come and premiere their films here. And the section's only 10 films, so we try to get a good diverse group of people, be it female filmmakers, filmmakers from different parts of the country, international filmmakers. This year we have 8 world premieres, 1 U.S. premiere, and 1 film that played Sundance. And so, we try to find a good, not too much of one type of film. Not too
many. You don't want like 10 zombie films.
Right, no 10,
mix it up a little bit.
10 found footage films or anything like that. It's just a good, like everything in our section, it's a very highly curated, and we kind of like take a step back and look at it, how it looks at as a whole. So we may not take a really good film because it's just getting bumped out by something else or,
presumably you don't also have a checklist where you're like, okay, zombie film, check, vampire film,
check. We definitely, if we have 6 zombie films, we notice that. Like this year, time travel was a big thing in all over the sections. But instead of just taking one of them, we took a lot of them.
Tonight.
Yeah, Predestination, The Infinite Man, Premature. There's tons of time travel is a big thing. Lo-fi sci-fi is also really big this year.
So I want to go back to what you were saying a minute ago about making connections with filmmakers. So just to give other filmmakers out there hope, if they submit a film to you and it doesn't get into South By, that doesn't necessarily mean their next film won't get in.
Right.
It can impress you enough that there could be a reason that film doesn't get in. Because as a filmmaker myself, I know a lot of filmmakers, we submit our films to festivals. We think, oh, it's a great fit for this fest. It doesn't get in, and then we're crushed. You've crushed our hopes and our dreams.
Yeah, the chances are not in your favor. There are 6,700 submissions, and we take 250 of them. So it's hard. I mean, it's a very it's a very subjective process on our part, and it's like just because we didn't take your film doesn't mean you didn't make a good film. I mean, there's so many other opportunities.
And there's probably agonizing decisions you guys make as a programming staff around, we really, really like these films, but there's just not a place to put it.
Yeah, and especially the midnight stuff. I mean, there's, a place like Fantasia or Fantastic Fest can have a breadth of genre programming because they have so many more slots. Like, we have to fill, we try to spread out genre throughout the program because we try to cheat and not just put them in the midnights. And so that's how I cheat, is I put them in other sections too.
Very sneaky, Jared.
Yes, absolutely. It's just, it is tough, absolutely, for filmmakers. But yeah, making short films that, we know that we kind of like, somebody like Jerome Sable, who directed The Legend of Beaver Dam, Stage Fright is his follow-up feature to that. And so that was, we knew him because of the short. And so, he didn't just come to us from out of nowhere. So he was kind of on our radar that way.
So if somebody gets on your radar with a short, then that might give their film...
Well, yeah, they can, email you and say, hey, what about, remember this? And then, yes, okay.
So can we, let's segue over to Lee here and talk about how her film came to you. Was that a submission, or did you find this film...
It was a submission, yes.
Lee, can you talk a little bit about... First, can you just kind of tell our audience a little bit about your film...
Can
kind of lure them into wanting to come and see it.
It's it's about a couple that goes on their honeymoon, and as you can tell, because it's in the midnight section, bad things continue to happen.
Yeah, I kind of glean that it's not a good honeymoon, right?
It's not a great honeymoon, although that would be an amazing movie too. Like, hey guys, we're just happy.
It's a midnight film about a happy couple, and everything's great. Nothing bad happens.
Exactly.
Rose petals on the bed. It's all lovely.
Lovely.
Yeah, I think the two of her two leads are really kind of inspired casting. I mean, it's Rose Leslie from Game of Thrones and Downton Abbey, and Harry Treadaway, who's the brother of Luke Treadaway, and he's actually going to be the new Penny Dreadful series on Showtime. He plays Dr. Frankenstein. So they're kind of two TV actors who are, dipping their toes into the film.
And, yeah, and I mean, Harry actually had a really extensive kind of indie filmography before I had seen him in Control, which is the Joy Division biopic, and I saw he was in Andrea Arnold's Fish Tank. But this is the first, for both of them, it's the first time that they have a whole movie kind of to carry themselves.
Yeah, they're great together.
Yeah.
And how did you cast them? How did that come about that you got these actors for your film?
Rose, I had read the Game of Thrones books, and it was pretty much like right after season 2 on Game of Thrones, and I knew the trajectory of her character. I knew she was going to grow and become a really integral part of the show, but she hadn't yet broken. And so I kind of just...
So you snagged that.
I did. I was able to. It was very strategic.
Very preemptive there.
No, she lights up the screen anytime she's on it, and I'd seen that in Downton, I'd seen it in Game of Thrones, and I knew that there was going to be a small window of time before everyone
felt like she was on
her.
The verge of popping.
Yeah, exactly.
You had the opportunity.
I was extremely lucky that she responded to the material. And Harry, it was more of a process. It's hard to find a male actor that doesn't just fall into like a archetype of like, I'm the guy that is in a frat. I'm the guy that does this. And he just embodies a really nice mixture of masculinity, but also, like, there's more dimension to him. So,
Jared, what did you like about Lee's film?
Yes, Jared.
Yes.
Since it was one of the films that got the coveted slot.
Yeah, absolutely. Got the opening night slot, actually, even. It's just...
So you really, really liked it. I really liked it.
I liked it. I recognize, I love the actors, so that kind of drew me to it to begin with. That was kind of like the hook for me, and, you know, it's just her direction and her story, like being a first-time filmmaker, female filmmaker for a genre section is kind of rare, so that was also awesome to see that, and the way she handled the material, and, you know, just the way she composed it, and the way the choices she made, you know, the script is really strong, and but it's a very kind of, you know, it's a slow burn kind of film.
And you wrote the script also?
I co-wrote it with my writing partner.
Yeah. And so it's just, it's a wonderful film, and it's super creepy, and, you know, everyone, I mean, it was one of our favorites, and, you know, we just, like, whenever, it was so early in the process, we were able to, like, pass it around to all these people, and like, hey, oh, you gotta check this one out, you gotta check, and everyone came back like, yes, yes, love it. Nice. And sometimes it's like, oh, yeah, I liked it, like, you like it more than me. But this was one of the ones that was like,
or sometimes
everyone
you
loved
have
it.
To like throw down the gauntlet and say, no, I want this film in, but this was
totally.
One where the whole program.
Yeah, this was a super easy choice.
And...
it was like, yes, that's a definite. And so, yeah, we're thrilled. I mean, we always think people are going to love it, and so it's always great whenever people actually do love it. So,
we have just about a minute left. So I want to jump over to Lee again really quick because the point that Jared made that we don't see a lot of female filmmakers in this genre.
Sure.
Why this genre for you?
I've just been a big sci-fi fan my whole life. I love horror too, but I consider myself more of a sci-fi person than straight horror. And it made sense to make something that I would love to watch. And I think that's the key for filmmakers generally, is to really embrace what you love and don't try to play some kind of game of like, I think that if I do this kind of film, it's going to get me exposure. Like, just do what you want to see. And
you can definitely tell that she loves the material, and that I know that we say a lot of times, it's like some people try to make a copy of a good film. Like, they see a film they really like, and they try to make a copy of that film. But you can tell this was a very original story and a voice that you could just kind of shine through.
And it played well with the
audience. Absolutely.
It's great. It was a really good premiere. So.
Yeah, and one of the things that I actually really love about South By is that you don't have press screenings, and so the press is forced to see the midnight films with an audience.
And not on their phones.
And not on their phones, and not in a press screening with a bunch of surly critics. So hopefully the press response
best.
Has also been
it's
really
very, very,
very
well.
Very
yeah. Great reviews.
Excellent. Well, Jared Neese and Lee Janiak, thank you very much for stopping by Daily Buzz. This has been day two of Daily Buzz, presented by Cloud Electronics. We're here at the Stateside Theater in Austin, Texas, and we're going to get back to South by Southwest, and we will see you guys later.
Thanks, Kim. That's a wrap here in Austin. Daily Buzz at South by Southwest was made possible thanks to the support of some key people. Special thanks to Wes at Cloud Electronics, Michelle at Skull Candy, Lisa and Stephanie at the Stateside Theater, Leah Manners at KOOP, Tyler Ford in Salt Lake at KCBW, Jamie at SoundCloud, Laura at Texas Squeeze and Texas Tea, Marta at Texas Crystal Water, and Jessica at Kind Bars and Snacks. Special thanks to our co-hosts here at Daily Buzz at South by Southwest this year, Kim Voyner, Dave Karger, Eric Cohn, Kristen McCracken, and Amy Nicholson. We couldn't have done the show without you. And thanks to our Daily Buzz crew, Rose, Matt, Claire, Lancia, and Ross. Thanks so much, guys, for your tireless hours. A special VIP production crew team here in Austin made this possible this year. Lauren Hundley, Kristen Ang, Jessica Perrin, Jacques Coleman. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next year. In the meantime, this is Irene Cho, producer of The Daily Buzz. Catch The Daily Buzz at Cannes in May. See ya.